start this because I want to talk about that. So the question was asked of why so much minutia and elements of law, right? Rules and sorts of things in the Torah. And I think it's multi-tiered or multi-pronged. I think that when the Lord called Israel to an election, she had to live in the midst of wicked nations and attempt to be a light. Let's just leave it real simple. Let's just use that analogy. She was supposed to be a light to the nations. And there was no understanding of good and evil until the Lord essentially gave it. Okay? So where you have in Noah and the flood and these different elements of things happening, cognitive understanding of good and evil, I think it's something that men learned. It's not just we have a conscience, oh, this is bad, this is good. But it's like you said last week, why weren't there people that didn't burn their kids on the fires? We are so far removed from that time. I think that it was so incredibly different in regards to... Suzanne told me to stop saying that. She said I say it too much in the teachings. In regards to... pertaining to... She said you need a new phrase. But you had a revelation of God being holy. That's what you said. But you had a nation that needed to be different from the nations around her. So in the same way that we as a Christian today would need to be different, right? What separates us, right? We all know there are many facets. Well, it's not hard. I'll give you an example. this was pretty funny. I was in a real estate office here in Westcliff, and when they were talking, and this lady was in here helping us, and this old man came in, you know, just a old man who thought he was going to make a joke with some young guys. And so the girl walks out of the room, and he goes, you boys think she'd sit on my lap. You know, he said something just crude. We didn't say anything. We just looked away, and I think it was pretty awkward for him. So he's like, so what do you boys do? And I was with two of my friends, and they go, we're Bible teachers. And you could just record scratch. you could tell he's just like, and so he's like, well, me too. You know, the Lord's my, you know, get up and talk to the Lord every day. And I almost was just like, no, you're not. No, you're not a Christian. And don't try to tell me now that you are, when you just did that, right? Because in no way were you going to represent the character of the Lord. But I didn't, you know. I think maybe next time. I'd like to think that I would. But so we can all recognize within ourselves contradiction, of course, in the gospel. We all know where we're at, but or I hope that we do. But contradiction in the gospel is something that the Lord's very serious about, right? Would that guy, I mean, I don't know. What's the point of, does he have actual faith? It would be unlikely, right? Because actual faith is not going to seek to contradict itself, to make a joke, a sexual joke about a lady to some younger guys, right? The other day, man, another situation like that happened, but that guy was just totally not a believer. But there was this guy in my coffee shop just going on and on about his, you know, sexcapades in Ethiopia, and he didn't know that the window was busted out, you know, in my front of the coffee shop, and his wife was standing right outside.
Oh, no.
So that was another, like, the day of the Lord, you know. She just came and opened the door and peeked in, and he looked back and he goes, oh, you ready to go? You know, like, I'm not in here talking like a total moron. And she just gave him this look like, man, it was so intense. And then he looked back at me And he was concerned, like, she must have heard. How could she have heard? And then he looks up and he sees the window, and he knew that she was standing right on the other side of it, right? And so, man, how intense is the day of the Lord, the mini day of the Lord came upon that guy. I was just like, because I was so worked up in my spirit, and he was just kind of trying to impress a young man with his things, that I was about to go there with him. That's how I felt, like, from the Holy Spirit. Like, I was about to burst and just tell him, like, hey, man, the day of the Lord is coming. And as I was getting to that point, and I don't know if I was going to do it, but I felt that way. His wife came in, and that was the day of the Lord for him, you know, in a way. I'm spiritualizing it, but the day of the Lord will be like that. How bad was it for that guy to go get in the truck with his wife? I don't know if he did that while they're married and she didn't know, and that was the first time to hear it, or if he did it before or whatever, but suddenly he was going to be called to account, right? And that guy in the real estate office would be called to account. I'm saying all that because, so there's the facet back to the question of what's happening. I think it's multi-tiered. You have, in the Garden of Eden, we asked for the knowledge of good and evil, okay? And I talked about this a little, I think, before. We asked for the knowledge of good and evil. It was not a task the Lord, I believe, wanted us to carry, okay? When we were created in the garden, he possessed all of the knowledge of good and evil. It was his. And, you know, of course it begs the question, which is a misuse of that fallacy, but to put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden and then put the tree of life, you know, hard things to talk about. He'll explain that in the age to come. But we wanted, he said, do not do that, right? It wasn't just a rule. It was a, oh my goodness, I'm the Lord and have the foreknowledge to know what will unfurl if you want to bear the knowledge of good and evil. But I think that some of those, you know, whatever that word would be, cosmological, or the beginning of how this all started begins with, and we haven't played it out far enough within Christian theology, that we, part of the sin and part of the burden that came upon us was bearing the knowledge of good and evil. We would then know what was good and bad from there forward. And so I would say we probably got a portion of it when we ate the fruit, you know. I don't know, they were suddenly ashamed, they were naked. But then, oh my goodness, the Lord comes down at Mount Sinai and he really begins to give, right? If you're an adulterer, you're going to die. If you're a liar, you're going to die, you know. I mean, he doesn't say that, but do not do these things. Don't worship idols. Don't worship any other god. And so I kind of think of that like the second knowledge of good and evil. And this is just my own, like, working through these things, but my own opinion. But there you have this exponentially greater physical, like, literal sentences out of the Lord's mouth of what good and evil is. Idolatry is evil. Worshiping me is good. And so you just have 10 words. They're called the Dabar, right? The 10 words from God, which are the covenant himself that he is making with Israel. It's based upon this marriage covenant. So he's, I believe, giving the knowledge of good and evil. The Torah, the world at this point today, I don't know where we would be. We can't say that our government system today did not steadily progress from just those simple 10 commandments to, I mean, what's the deal today? Is adultery legal? It's actually illegal, right, in our culture, but there's not a prosecution for it. But if you're married, it's illegal, right? It's illegal within the court to commit adultery, but there's not really a prosecution for it any longer. Murder, right? Where did the idea that murder is wrong come from? Did we just get, like, again, that cognitive learning? And one day, you know, a long time ago, a man said, oh, murder's wrong, you know. It's pretty clear that from Cain and Abel, murder is wrong, but for the Lord.
Didn't God, when he created us, because he is good and he is the creator, weren't we kind of already equipped with a conscience of sorts, with an instinctual understanding that that's good, that's not?
I don't think so, but that's my own opinion. It wouldn't appear to be that way because of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I think if we're very pragmatic with it, was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it would seem that they did not possess that before.
Yeah, that Adam and
it was ultra innocent. It was ultra innocent, right? Or hyper innocence, where God knew everything. And that whole saying, ignorance is bliss. Where does that come from? I don't know.
So the idea of evil didn't even pass through their thought process. Like, I'm so angry at that person, I would kill him.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
They wouldn't.
And that's why the resurrected mind would probably, will mirror the Garden of Eden, you know? The resurrected mind, when the law, and so this is going to play into what you're saying here. What is the point of the resurrection and the age to come is the Lord puts his law, right, in our hearts. He writes it on the heart so that they can, it says, so they can no longer transgress my laws. Because, so it's not just a bunch of rules, it's part of him. It's part of who he is. And that's why Jesus says, right, Matthew 5, not one jot or tittle will pass from the law until all is fulfilled. Right? I'm still always wondering what a tittle is, but
it's a little Hebrew mark.
Oh, it's a Hebrew mark. Ah, thank you. Thank you. Oh, it's like the mark for Aleph. The second, okay, I know what you're saying. Do not think. Okay. Do not think that I came to abolish the law, the Torah, or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. And then he says, whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments will be called least in the kingdom, meaning they will not inherit it. He who keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom. So, when does that kind of satisfy that question, Carlin? So I think it's multi-tiered. Yes, it's God.
Yeah.
And the revelation of the Torah is the revelation of God. If that's where he chose to start, it's how he chose to start the revelation of himself. Right? When I was talking to those guys just earlier in the cafe, one of them said, I was telling him about how we're taught to start in Matthew instead of Genesis. And he said, that's funny. He said, I've been thinking recently how Genesis to me seems like the end of my Bible and Matthew seems like it's the beginning. And I said, that's the best articulation I've ever heard someone say, because you're exactly right. That's what you've been taught and trained. That's how you've been trained to think about the scriptures. But Matthew or Genesis 1:1 should be as important to us as Matthew 1:1, right? It should. But why is it not? Why, when we read Genesis 1:1, it's like, yeah, that's the verse I've always heard. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But if it's if it's pivotal and it's the foundation that God starts his scriptures with, right, in the Torah, it's revealing who he is. So that's what we've tried to talk about in articulation of the gospel. This is the framework. This is the playing field, right? The heavens and the earth and humans. We've talked about the distinction or the dichotomy between this age and the age to come, right? That there is a juxtaposition between the two. There's a dividing line from this age to the age to come. That's the on our timeline between A to B and then B to C. A to B is this age and B to C is the age to come. So we've talked about the characters, within people, kind of coming from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. and how those trajectories have likely set up the entire earth to be the way that it is today. So all we've done, and this is what I was trying to say last week, in the last 22 sessions, is try to create a lens that sees the components, that sees all of the context of the story, so that now we go to the scriptures and the story makes sense. That's all we've done. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So we've spent 22 sessions, and Sterling will tell you this is. Did you ever have anything like that in seminary? Like what? Like hermeneutics class? What was?
something like that. I'm not sure exactly what your question is.
Sorry, my question is, would they have ever taken so much time just to try to set the context for understanding the Bible?
No.
Or a context for trying to help you. To me, when I grabbed onto hermeneutics, right, and this is my method of interpretation, I just had to back up and go, wait a second, how come no one told me this is important? The way that I read the Bible is important. And it's because of, I don't know, it could be like a humanistic Christianity or self-centered Christianity where it's just, hey, brother, all these scriptures just apply to you through grace in Christ Jesus. Be blessed, right? And that's a lot of people's faith. And so I'm not trying to hark on them or throw them under the bus because maybe they've just never even gone back far enough to think about it. But just to take so much time to try to create a new lens so that, and that's what I told you in the beginning, the only point of this Bible class is I've tried to do the best I can do to try to give you tools to just read the Bible and enjoy it and understand what it's saying for the rest of your life. That's my only hope, right? It's not like this is all going somewhere to me being the next N.T. Wright or something. Like, that's laughable. I found out N.T. Wright prays in tongues this week, though.
How about that?
How about that? That was really, I think the Lord may be humbling N.T. Wright. But yeah, N.T. Wright's prayed in tongues, so that's kind of neat to hear. So, as we now, man, I had kind of this hesitancy this week. And as we were coming to this first column and I was going, man, is it going to be boring for us to now just open our Bibles and read through these scriptures? And the Lord had to really correct me and go like, no, this is this is my word. Wait, you think it's going to be boring because you're not just like teaching? Like, man, Stephen, like what do you think of yourself here? Like, but I had to kind of realize that in general church, if we sat down and I said, all right, today we're going to do is read through these scriptures. And that's what we're going to like likely do for the next many weeks to come, right? We're just going to start here at Genesis 1:1 and we're just going to read through these and begin discussing them. There's still some things that, I'll give context to. I was like, but people aren't used to that model, right? It's probably going to feel even boring at some points, but here we go. So we're diving in to that. In order to work through, I know everyone's probably more excited like about the eschatology and the point B to C, like talking about that. Really, which is exciting. I'm going to maybe talk from the end of this before we start. But if we are living at this point right here, and you have that other diagram where I've showed you that I believe, we're close to the return of Jesus. That is the Israel diagram and with Kiliasm. I don't know if you guys.
It's in here somewhere.
Yeah, it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
really took that to heart and studied it, but that would be my plea with you, because I believe that if we are close to the return of Jesus, then it changes the way that we live, right? It changes the way that we live. It drastically affects what we think about life and the next 20 years, how we're going to live it, what we spend money on, what we watch, entertainment we take in, how we're discipling ourselves in regards to even food. You know, sometimes I'm catching myself wanting to just eat steak all the time, and we'll sit down at the table with my kids and I'll say to them, guys, this is a blessing. And recently, I've said it so many times, you know, recently Shiloh just cut me off and she's like, yeah, but the time could come when we're not going to be able to eat steak and we should be thankful. I was like, exactly. It changes. Priorities change. If Jesus is coming, if the greatest, most cataclysmic event in all of, you know, definable, articulatable history is about to come upon the earth, it changes the way that we live. It really does. It makes everything different. And so we talked intensely last week about becoming a partaker of the gospel. In order to become partakers, that we do all things to become partakers of this gospel and of this narrative. It means that, you know, sometimes, well, it means all kinds of things. And for each person, it's different. We all have to figure out what that means, you know. But it means the Lord, you welcome the pruning of the Lord to your life, is just what it means. It's like, okay, I am surrendering. And then you're like, oh, crud, I didn't know that dead branch was there. And the Lord's like, yeah, I'm cutting that off. And it's like, no, don't cut that one off. And he's like, yeah, I'm cutting that one off too. And then you're like, oh, no, you know, I didn't know that dead branch was there. And so he begins to cut away as the great pruner, to just refine us as vessels to become partakers of his gospel. But sometimes it's scary and hard for us to just say yes to, but it's always worth it. And that's where those passages about this age versus the age to come are so glorious. You know, we don't know what he's prepared, but eye has not seen nor ears heard what he's prepared for those who believe. The sufferings of this time are not comparable to what will be revealed in the glory to come. You know, when Paul says those things, I don't know what's in his mind, but I know he stood in the third heaven and heard things that humans shouldn't hear, he said. Which makes you go, what in the world is going on up there? But it will be, the reward will be so far beyond what we really can understand that forsaking everything for his gospel is just worth it, you know. It's worth it to live for the return of Jesus. I catch a lot of flack. I was rebuked, you know, this week by an older, very well-educated gentleman in regards to my approach to the return of Jesus. And I just had to stand my ground. I had to stand my ground and say, this is why I believe this. And some things you heard aren't true. Sounds like these things have been exaggerated, because he had been told by someone that I set a date for the return of Jesus, that I said it will be in 15 years. And I said, no, I said, that's, to tell you the truth, that's my hope. I hope Jesus comes within a 15-year window, but I do believe we're in the generation. And I said, and that's what I communicate, you know. But to stand for the return of Jesus and to hold to a theology of Jesus is coming will put you in a box. It will. Others will put you in a box. You'll get accused of being a fatalist and just trying to escape, not wanting to do things in this age. It's just crazy, the things that people come up with instead of hoping and instead of hoping in the glorious day of Jesus being glorified in the sight of all the nations. You know, we're afraid of eschatology. We're worried about Jesus finally being vindicated as the man on the cross and the leader of Israel and the creator and glorified above every other god or so-called god. It's like, man, we've really gotten off track with what we think eschatology is. Like, he's been hoping for this for 6,000 years. So it's important, because I'm kind of working backwards through the diagram on purpose here, because the time of Jacob's trouble, as we will get to, and I'll just tell you, when we get to that session, the only thing that's going to happen is I'm going to try, man, I can't even like start talking about it. I'm going to try to start talking about it, and I'm going to just cry. I'm not going to try to. I'm not working up emotion, but that's what's going to happen. I've accidentally just burst into tears with perfect strangers talking about that subject, because it's very deep in my heart, and I have Jewish faces. And I just have Jewish faces in my mind. And this time of trouble is coming, and how we respond to that and act in the midst of it is pertinent to our faith, I believe. So that's why we're leaving that kind of for the end. But everything is pushing towards this hopeful cataclysmic event of his return. It's the...
What does the average, if there is one, Jewish individual today, either here or in Israel or anywhere else, what is their understanding of the time of Jacob's trouble? Do they have an understanding? Because I mentioned that briefly in my mall discussions, and it was like
you mentioned it. Yeah, you've got to take them to Deuteronomy. And we're going to get to this here at this column. And again, it's a subject we have to like really take a couple sessions to wade through.
But do they recognize that? Do they
some of them do.
Contextualize that? Or do they think that's some sort of a euphemism for...
A lot of them think it was the Holocaust, right? And naturally they would. You can understand, right? If your immediate grandparents had lived through, you know, six million of your... people being rounded up and put in.
But even if you're in discussion, indicating that is ahead and coming, I'm kind of floored by what they... I thought everybody would be keyed into that. I thought
no.
That would be important.
Yeah.
And they would at least know what that was. And they didn't. They didn't know what the word Gentile was. Maybe I should have said Goyim.
Yeah. That's what I normally say.
You would have said, yeah.
Yeah.
But I just kind of wonder, these are so incredibly important and impactful elements coming.
Yeah. Well, it's like the church doesn't know either, though, right? The church isn't aware of it. So
yeah,
you've got a lot of unawareness. But in regards to their own narrative as the Jewish people, there are some who do believe that there's a time of trouble coming. And they see it.
It's a small amount.
And they're not... What's that?
It's a small amount.
Probably, but they also don't want to talk about it, because I'll tell you, it's not hard. If you just start looking up articles on anti-Semitism rise around the world, I'll give you an example with this whole... better be careful here. With the whole phrase of white privilege that's being used, you know, now in this the narrative of Black Lives Matter, and I'm not going to talk about that whole thing, but within that narrative of the issue, the problem is white privilege. Someone was going around to major universities in the United States and putting up flyers, or I don't know how this was happening or where it was happening, but Suzanne showed me the article. And the flyer said, white privilege will not end until Jewish privilege does. White privilege will not end until Jewish privilege does. So they're saying, no, the issue is not white privilege. There's a deeper issue, Jewish privilege. Okay, so this just totally blew my mind. Okay, it made me realize the pressure that is coming to the world, it would seem totally unrelated to put that on a flyer. White privilege is related to Jewish privilege. Most of us would just go, what are you talking about, right? But there is a narrative within Satan, and there's a narrative that the Lord has allowed because of covenantal unfaithfulness that is going to climax. And this is why I use that analogy of the pot of boiling water is on the stove and it's just starting to bubble. Okay? Jacob's trouble is when it overflows in a raging boil. But you have those components of coming all the way back to Shem, Ham, and Japheth. You have a hatred of the Holy Covenant. You have a Shem was chosen, we were not. And somehow that has played out and is playing out all the way through to today, to where the Jewish people are the reason for white privilege. I mean, it just blew my mind. It blew my mind that this was being posted. But it made me realize it's the same old game. This narrative exists in anti-Semitism, and you can call it that. I don't even really like that phrase, because at the end of the day, it's hatred of the Holy Covenant. It's hatred of God. It's hatred of what he's chosen. It's hatred of his scriptures. It's hatred of his people, which is anti-Semitism. But it's a big pie, right? Hatred of the Jewish people, that's just an ethnic hatred, is anti-Semitism. Hatred of the whole thing, though, is hatred of God. So I said to Suzanne that night, I said, we were just talking about these things and why it's taking place. And I said, well, somehow this is going to be related to Jacob's trouble and the nations hating the Jews. And that's when she said, oh my gosh, I have to show you an article. Because if we take the covenant and what's taken place through history, right? And that's why I went through that timeline with the Jewish people that one night was, in that one teaching, was to show that it doesn't matter what generation it was, from Jesus to now, the Jews were to blame for the Black Plague, right? For the different events. There were things that went up about COVID, you know? Conspiracy theories that it was created in a lab in Israel so that they could create a whatever it's called and benefit monetarily from it. And that may have just been a farce, I don't know, but we will not see a farce in the days to come. The scripture is true, and the covenant is too sealed and bounded with a cyclical example all through history that the Jewish people come to be the bullseye for culture and the scapegoat. Going back to your scapegoat teaching, that'll be a neat addition to it, right? To add the Jewish people into it. That the Jews become the scapegoat for some reason in society. And it seems like, I say that, it seems like for some reason, this is just wild. Why would we ever blame the Jews? But it's because of the scriptures. It's because of the covenant. And it's because of the way the covenant is sealed with the Lord. And we'll get to that in a lot more detail. We did read through it a couple months ago, I think. But when we get to this, and what I call the gears of the covenant, and understand that it's what's propelling and driving all of history forward, and it's what is essentially bringing the Jewish people to become the scapegoat over and over, to become the Romans 9 vessels of wrath so that he could have mercy on other vessels. They are going to become that scapegoat again for society to blame. It seems almost preposterous now to consider that. But Joel Richardson has a really good book called When a Jew Rules the World.
Yeah. That's not his name, you know.
What's that?
That's not his name.
Yeah, yeah. But it's got a history of Jewish persecution in it, a whole chapter on it. It's crazy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt and just wild people you would have never thought of, violent anti-Semitists, mm-hmm. who somehow, again, like, it's that, it's so odd, it's so strange. I was driving through Missouri, just past random farms, and, you know, people put up, like, signs for, like, a vote for this guy or vote for that, or these days it's gotten more political. Like, I drove past a sign. I'd have to take time to find you the picture. It was a yellow 18-wheeler that had been painted yellow with black writing on it that said, Israel, the parasite that sucks the life out of the American society. And it said something else, and starves your children. It was just a couple claims, and I was like, what made this random farmer in Missouri feel that he needed to make that statement on a highway? It was on 71 South. But it's not, it seems crazy, but it's not. And that's what I'm saying. It is growing. I told you guys about the float, right, in Belgium. Did I tell you about the float and the parade? Belgium had a parade last year, and I don't remember what they're celebrating, but it was just their yearly parade, and some guys decided to do a float that was oriented around anti-Semitism. So they took images from Hitler's propaganda, and they made gigantic paper mache, like big nose Jews wearing their hats. It was just a mockery of Jewish people. It was a float, a float devoted to the mockery of Jewish people. It went through the parade and it was a hit. Jews protested. The governor was silent and said, I'm not going to make them recant. I'm not going to make them apologize. So let me ask you this question. If at our 4th of July parade, next week, and all around different big cities, if there was a float devoted to mocking African Americans, right? Let's just, whatever caricatures. What would happen? What would happen in our nation? Civil war. Civil war. Civil war, right? And this isn't, I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again for the sake of this recording. Like, it doesn't, black, white, race is not a biblical thing. Like, we're all Gentiles or we're Jewish, right? So all Gentiles are equal. That's it. And we're all equally stupid in regards to our sin and ways. But the fact that the difference there, right? You can just float that down the road. You can hang that in a university, a flyer that says Jews are the problem. No issue. Right? Do Jewish lives matter? Right? No, they don't. And that's the problem. Right? That's the problem.
It's interesting that Martin Luther's anti-Semitic beliefs are under the radar.
Yeah.
You know, most people think of Martin Luther.
They just write it off. Yeah.
And they don't even know about that.
And I've talked to seminary leaders about that very issue, what's the deal with that? They just kind of like play it off like, oh, he kind of lost his mind at the end of his life. Really? I mean, because Hitler quotes him in Mein Kampf, right? Hitler quotes Martin Luther in Mein Kampf, my struggle. He even praises Martin Luther as being a forerunner and seeing the Jews as the problem. Okay, so if a whole theological system is built off of a man who Hitler praised, might be a red flag in there somewhere.
I'm going to get crucified for saying that one. Martin Luther grabbed because he was senile and nothing else to think about. Little seeds were in his life the whole time.
Yeah, it's strange, but it's not strange, and I keep saying that. It's strange, but it's not strange, because it is Satan, yes, but it is God. And that's the hardest thing that we will have to come out of this course with, is the Lord has allowed anti-Semitism and replacement theology as a consequence to his people for covenant unfaithfulness. It's not just Satan. We can't just attribute it to Satan, because he is the one, God is the one who said he would do this if they were unfaithful. It's the issue of the firstborn. It is. It's the discipline upon the firstborn, right? Was I disciplined far more harshly than my brothers and sisters? Of course. Why? Because I was the firstborn. My parents were figuring out if they're going to spank hard or spank more, and they did both, and it was good for me. But anyway, I'm floundering a little here, so let's just I'm trying to give context to if we, to just back to last week of becoming a partaker. It's pragmatically and practically, it means that we are figuring out how to orient our lives. And I say that phrase, our lives, and I hate that. We're trying to figure out how to surrender our lives, but we're orienting our lives because we're all living life. We are orienting the circumstances, our pursuits, our passions. We're orienting all of those things in our life for all of them to fall into the trajectory of the gospel. I believe that's the calling of the gospel. I believe if we preached that gospel, there would be a lot more devotion, I think, to the Lord and his gospel. So in regards to that being practical and imminent in future, why am I trying to use these weird sentences? There's practical implications of what's happening in the future. And if our lives are, and those things are pertaining to the gospel, we are looking at them and then trying to now orient our lives in a way that is surrendered to the gospel so that we can bear fruit in this time to come. But I believe it is the most glorious hour for the church to shine. And I believe that it's sad that our gospel has this gigantic hole that's not preparing people for what's coming. So we have this huge gap. Like I said, I've like punched the jugular of people that are big theological guys, some guys that are in this community, and other missionaries that I met in the field pleading. And it's not, I'm not punching the jugular in this arrogant way. I'm talking about, I'm trying to say, look, there's an issue here. The issue is you're not preparing people for what is coming. And so then we have a sleeping bride in Matthew 25, a sleeping bride that's not prepared. What happens? The bridegroom comes and the oh crap moment happens and they run to the door. And he says, the door's already been closed. Oh my goodness, how many examples does Jesus have to give about being prepared for his coming for the church to really wake up and want to grab a hold of it and stop espousing this narrative of everyone before us believed that, so don't fall into that. I detest that mentality. I detest it. It's so, so hard for me to talk to people about that because Jesus goes out of his way to try to help us prepare and to want to be prepared, to not have it come upon us like a thief, right? His whole point of all these things is, I don't want that day to come on you like a thief. And so he gives us all this context. Look for all these things so the day doesn't come on you like a thief. And then we go, oh yeah, but every generation before us thought that. What a cop-out. Yeah. It's just a theological cop-out. And then we create a whole doctrine, pre-tribulation rapture, that finally satisfies what we need. He's going to come and we will not go through it. Oh my goodness. So then, how many people espouse that? Gigantic churches, Gateway in Dallas, right? How many thousands of members? He teaches adamantly pre-tribulation rapture theory that the Lord is going to come before this idea of tribulation comes because a God of love would not make us go through that. Really? So the Iranian Christians rounded up and beheaded on those beaches. How about those guys? Did they go through a tribulation? Oh, but because we live in Dallas and we're wealthy, he's not going to make us go through that, right? Oh my goodness. Serious, serious thing. So we've created now a doctrine that avoids the return of Jesus because we don't need to worry about it. He could come at any day or hour, brother. I'm just ready. What's that? Yeah. We're going to be raptured. We're going to go up and live in eternal bliss. The gospel from beginning to end never has that component of avoiding suffering. The gospel, in fact, has central to its core suffering, right? And the Messiah himself came and embodied it. And Peter says, 2 Peter in 1 Peter 3, therefore we have an example to follow in his footsteps because he suffered, it says. He was crucified, so we have an example to follow in his footsteps. So I'm just saying all this to say, man, it's going to be exciting to get to eschatology. And it started getting me worked up because I'm super passionate about it, of course. I believe it's the most important and most overlooked thing in our generation. It's the theological hole that we want to just act like it's not there. It's the elephant in the room. And we cop out in so many ways. Well, I haven't studied it. There's plenty of resources to study it. Some people don't really believe that way, so I don't really know if I can go there. Well, then that's really dangerous for the sake of their salvation, because one of the first things Jesus says is the love of many will grow cold in that time. And actually, the word in Greek is most. The word in Greek is most. Okay, so if the love of most grows cold, it means there were genuine people that loved him. They genuinely had love for him. And the love of most grew cold and they fell away. They fell away. And so we're not just talking about some time of 7 years that's going to, you know, that we're going to dance through the field of lilies for the sake of the gospel. It's going to test us to the core. And so my springboard to all that was, I say to my kids, we may not have steak to eat in the future, you know. When we're taking baths, I say, we may not be able to take baths in the future. You know, this is a blessing. We may not have hot water. We have a 16-gallon water heater in our cabin. That's about a 7-minute shower. And so we frequently just kind of laugh at each other because Suzanne and I will just have to take a shower together sometime. And it's not like an intimate thing. We're trying to like scrub off and wash off because we both needed a shower. You know, the kids, we can fill up like a 4-inch bath. You know, they can't even take a bath. But the Lord, I think, through all that, my only goal was like get a water heater in the past. And Sterling was going to help me install one. And it was like, through all that, the Lord's like, no, just deal with it, you know. But now I'm trying to get a water heater. I'm still trying to do it because I want to take a long shower before this time of trouble. But I think we're seeking, I'm not trying to make this myself the hero of the story or something here, but we're trying to orient our lives towards a gospel that is heading towards suffering. We haven't experienced that in America, right? We haven't. I've never been punched in the face and beaten because I'm a believer in Jesus. I haven't. I knew a pastor in Nepal who was a Hindu priest who came to Christ. And they wrapped him in the yak skin to dry him out. And then they beat the crap out of him. They beat him to the point of death. And he lived. And that happened to him. Not just once, but 3 times in his life, he was beaten to the point of death. Struggling, living, and now he's a pastor of a, you know, it's a small church, but amazing, you know. And that's normal in Nepal. And here we have a pre-tribulation rapture theory that's going to save us from persecution. It is so contradictory, and I'm going to say this, it is so dishonoring of those who have suffered before us to say we're going to be saved from it. It's dishonoring them. But I know it's something that a lot of people believe, and so I try to tread lightly on that, but I'm not treading lightly on it tonight.
You know, we used to watch a lot of CBN and things like that. I'll swear, a buddy that came on that program
believed that.
Big time people believe that.
Mm-hmm. You know. It's just because none of us want to suffer. It's part of human nature. None of us want to suffer. But if we want to be like Christ, there kind of becomes this, like when I went to Nepal the first time, or when I was going to go to Nepal the first time with my buddy, I was like, will there be a chance for persecution? You know, and he's like, I don't know, you know. He's like, we'd have to get out into the mountain areas. I was like, well, let's go. Like, let's just preach the gospel and at least be beaten once while we're there. And he's like, bro, like, you're out of your mind. But at that time in my life, I remember like I was going through such a hard season. I was struggling with pornography, just to be honest. And I wanted the gospel to be real to me. And I wanted to know that I was going to endure that for Christ. So I was like, let's just go out and at least get beaten once. We did it. I didn't go on that trip. But so I've never been persecuted that way for my faith. I've been mocked. I've been in situations one time where I thought a guy was going to knock me clean out, but he didn't. But the time will come, the glorious hour of faith in the body of Christ being called to account, the rubber meeting the road. And part of it is adventurous and exciting, and part of it is scary. But I think by the Holy Spirit, you know, our love will stand firm and we will endure it.
You know, when it says in the scripture, a student will not be greater than his teacher.
Perfect.
And a slave greater than his master.
Yeah.
How can we know what Jesus' life was and think we're going to sail through and then get raptured out at the last, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And Revelation says, I know it says, that, you know, those that have been beheaded, they're going to be the first people to
resurrected.
To be resurrected.
Uh-huh.
So, and I know there are people who already get beheaded.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, it kind of sounds like they're not going to be pre-raptured.
Raptured
before them.
Exactly. That's what's happening in Revelation 6:2. The souls are crying out from under the altar. How much longer? And it says, until, it says, here's a white robe. It says, until your other brethren who are to be killed as you were is finished, is complete. That's the verse. The souls under the altar in Revelation 6, right before the return of Jesus. It says, this is in the fifth seal, the martyrs. They say, how long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And there was given to each of them a white robe. And this is what they were told. You should rest for a little while longer until the number of your fellow servants and your brethren who are to be killed as you were would be completed also. This, and again, is it trying to avoid suffering? The preterist approach to eschatology puts all of this in Rome before 70 AD. All of it completed. I wonder if there's that avoiding suffering for the sake of the gospel mixed into that approach. Oh, it's all been fulfilled. This isn't going to happen. No, so the martyrs are told, don't worry. There's many more coming that are going to be killed just like you've been killed. So just take some more rest. It's interesting. That's what Jesus talks about in the Abraham's bosom example. Okay, so now here we are. 5:45. That's gone 53 minutes. I'm going to stop this, and then we'll just try to read through